Rise to Rebellion, Disc 18.
June 28, 1776. The committee was just three now, Livingston home in New York, Sherman tending to some business in the city. There had been several drafts of the document, and Jefferson had shown complete patience as Franklin and Adams applied their own hand to his words. After several days of quiet examination, all three men seemed more willing to focus less on perfection than on completion of the task. Franklin squinted, peered through his spectacles. "Here, we hold these truths to be sacred and undeniable. A bit flowery. I would suggest self-evident. Cut to the point. In this one, deluge us in blood." He looked at Jefferson now, smiled. "Bit of a poet, eh? I would suggest something a bit less, dramatic. I'd change that to destroy us. Again, just a bit closer to the point."
Adams was scanning the papers. "I have a suggestion here." Jefferson leaped up, his words bursting out. "I have only tried to include everything that seemed important. Forgive me for not phrasing every sentence in its most perfect form."
Franklin leaned back in the chair, raised one hand. "Mr. Jefferson, please sit down." Jefferson complied, folded his arms on the table, stared down in a thick sulk. Adams looked up from the document. "Is something wrong?"
Franklin shook his head. "No, I don't believe so. I have been observing our young friend here. He has been extremely generous in the manner in which he has accepted our amending of his work. But we have perhaps intruded just a bit too far into his pride. My apologies, sir."
Jefferson seemed surprised at Franklin's response to his outburst, looked at both men.
"It is no matter. The apology should come from this chair, doctor."
Franklin thought for a moment.
"Allow me to interrupt our thoughts for a moment. Anyone who offers to draft a document for public consumption puts himself at risk. I am reminded of someone I knew a while ago, a hatter. He was just opening his own business and wished to post an appropriate banner above his store. After much thought, he constructed a sign that included the drawing of a hat beside the words, 'John Thompson, Hatter, makes and sells hats for ready money.' As he showed his creation to his friends, one observed that the word hatter was redundant, since he also noted that he makes hats. Another friend noted that the word makes might as well be omitted because the customers would not care who made the hats. If they liked the hats, they would buy them no matter who their maker. Another stated he thought the words 'for ready money' to be useless, as everyone who purchased a hat would expect to pay. The changes were made, and the sign now read, 'John Thompson sells hats.' Another friend says, 'Sells hats? Why, no one would expect you to give them away. And being that there is a drawing of a hat on the board, why use the word at all?' Thus the merchant reduced the sign to 'John Thompson,' accompanied by the picture of a hat. He has been, I might add, rather successful."
He realized both men were staring at him with their mouths open, a show of complete fatigue. A moment later, Jefferson broke into laughter.
"Your point is well taken, doctor. I find no fault with either of you gentlemen. I spoke from a weakness of body, not mind."
Adams blinked at Franklin through tired eyes. "It has been my experience that, given enough time, we may find some reason to fault every single word of any sentence ever written. It is a lawyer's prerogative, you know. Doctor, I, for one, am weary beyond measure. If Mr. Jefferson has lost his patience for our meddling, perhaps it is time to stop meddling."
"Oh, no, by all means."
"He's right, young man."
Franklin tossed the paper in his hand to the center of the table.
"The Congress will certainly have some suggestions of their own. The best we can do for our cause and our exhaustion is accept that what we have produced, what Mr. Jefferson has produced, is more than adequate to the task."
Adams tossed his paper forward as well. "All right, so it is time. We should, I suppose, create one fairly clean document with not so many scribbles. If John Hancock has to read this aloud, we should eliminate any challenges."
Franklin laughed, said nothing in reply.
He cocked one eye over his spectacles, addressed Jefferson.
"You're the youngest. I motion that we take advantage of the stamina of youth. Mr. Jefferson should rewrite our draft."
Adams smiled.
"Second." "Motion carried."
Franklin arose, unwound the kinks in his back, saw Adams doing the same, said, "I will report to the chamber. Awaiting only the rapidity of Mr. Jefferson's penmanship, this committee is prepared to present its document." He moved to the stairway, saw Jefferson already at work, the pen scratching the paper in a flurry of motion. He began to move down, held himself carefully to the railing, then waited for Adams to move down beside him, said in a low voice, "Blessed are we who can rely so on the young." Adams started down in front of him, stopped suddenly, faced by Richard Henry Lee. Lee seemed out of breath. "Oh, forgive me, gentlemen. I took it upon myself to pay a visit."
Franklin made a quick motion up the stairs behind him. "Only a moment, Mr. Lee. I believe we are ready."
"Oh, my, that is wonderful. But, no, that's not what... I mean, there is extraordinary news. It seems Mr. Chase and Mr. Carroll deemed it wise to measure the sense of the people of Maryland. They have just returned from Annapolis. It seems the mood of the people there was so adamantly in favor of independence that it has inspired the royal governor to remove himself to a British man-of-war. I am delighted to tell you that we may now count Maryland among our supporters."
Franklin looked at Adams, felt Jefferson now standing close behind him. "That would be 12.
Chapter 44. Franklin. Philadelphia, July 2nd, 1776. Dickinson held the floor for more than an hour, his usual eloquence infused with what Franklin thought was a last, desperate plea for a cause that was already dead. The chamber was fully charged with the expectation of great debate, the tall windows thrown wide open, as though the voices should be allowed to carry far beyond this one cavernous room. He weighed Dickinson's words with as much care as his tired mind would permit, the warm breeze flowing through the chamber soothing him, tempering the July heat. He had been concerned that he might fall asleep, but Dickinson's passion, the man's desperation, held his attention. He had noticed the same reaction from Adams and from several of the radical delegates. Let the man have his say. Franklin still held Dickinson's opening words in his mind. "My conduct this day, I expect, will give the finishing blow to my popularity. Yet I had rather forfeit popularity forever than vote away the blood and happiness of my countrymen." It was honest and heartfelt, and Franklin knew that despite his eloquence and the man's own bull-headed certainty about his reasoning, Dickinson was probably right about his popularity. He tried to focus on the man's words now, could sense from Dickinson's tone that he was winding down. "If there is any pleasure in supporting war, I cannot see it here. You would ask me to vote for that which will guarantee our destruction. England has already pledged all of her resources to our suppression. And though so many of you are called upon to believe that the people of all our colonies are eager for this course, I do not believe it still. I cannot say more, except be prepared for what will follow. This is not a righteous course. Colonial soldiers will not march en masse to the trumpets of heaven. By accepting this document, you will have laid open the pathway for civil war. And if somehow God is to shine his light on your lust for independence, on the madness of popular fury, what then? It would be as though destroying our house in winter before we have built another shelter. We will suffer the consequences of our own foolishness. God help us. God help us indeed." He left the rostrum, and the room was oddly silent. No applause, none of the comments that followed every speech, the throng in the gallery above them perfectly polite. The Virginian Benjamin Harrison took the gavel now, was serving temporarily as the president of the Congress. Franklin glanced over to the men from Massachusetts, saw John Hancock seated with them, a symbolic show of kinsmanship. Harrison seemed unusually nervous, the man's boisterousness replaced by a solemn gaze over the room.
"Does anyone wish to respond to the honorable gentleman from Pennsylvania?"
Harrison looked toward Adams, a gesture that was almost automatic now, and Franklin watched him slowly stand up, all eyes on the man who had led so many of the debates before now. No one else had made a request to speak. Not even the usual parade of orators, the men who spent more time at the rostrum enjoying the resonance of their own voices than what they were saying. But this day was different, and there was no mistaking the mood of the room, that if anyone was fit to answer Dickinson's final plea, it would be John Adams. Adams never seemed comfortable in the role of speaker,
and Franklin studied him carefully, could read uncertainty in the man's movement and posture. He has yet to believe in his own talents. He is possibly the finest orator in this room, and is the only one among us who is not aware of that. Adams cleared his throat, and there was no other sound in the room. I have stated with vexing redundancy that what we are faced with is a crisis that can be solved only by discipline in the army, governments in every colony, and a confederation of the whole. Today I am forced to admit that those kinds of arguments sound more suited for the classroom. There was a sudden flash of light from outside, a hard clap of thunder. Franklin jumped, the reflex shared by everyone in the room. Adams looked toward the dark skies beyond the tall windows. "I may have an audience to which I am not so very accustomed." There was nervous laughter, heads turning toward the windows, which were rattling slightly, buffeted by a sudden gust of wind. There was another thunderclap, and rain began to fall, the wind blowing a hard mist through the windows. Adams waited, and the sounds of the storm now settled into a solid roar. Men rose, closed the windows slightly, deflecting the rain, and the room grew still once more. Adams continued. "I respect any man who possesses so strong a passion that he is willing to sacrifice anything dear to him to express it. Whether Mr. Dickinson has sacrificed his popularity, I am not certain. But I fear that he would have us sacrifice something much more of value. He speaks of blood, a sacrifice indeed. But memories are short, it seems. How much blood has already been shed by our countrymen at the hands of others? How many cities will be burned? How many of our town squares will be trampled under the boots of a foreign army? I agree with Mr. Dickinson that we may well be embroiled in a civil war, that there are colonial citizens who will fight against their own to hold to their king. But unlike Mr. Dickinson, I do not despair over what might be. I despair over what already is. The war has begun. The peace has been shattered beyond anyone's ability to repair it with words and petitions. What we are debating today is not whether there is wisdom or folly in a claim of independence. We do not seek out truths. We seek only to declare truths. You have all received the good and sincere wishes of your own assemblies, and thus your own people. If you would deny what your people want, is that not what began this crisis? We requested a voice in governing our own affairs. It was denied us. We have requested that King George set aside the ruinous policies of his ministers. It was denied us. We have requested in the most reasonable terms that the king's soldiers not harm us, not destroy our towns, and not endanger our very lives. It was denied us. He paused, glanced at the window, the storm still blowing, rain and wind swirling against the hall. If we do not declare our independence in a voice that blows against our enemies with the force and determination of this very storm, then we will suffer the fate of every people who have ever cast away their own freedom. We will wither and die under the weight of our own servility. I do not share Mr. Dickinson's call for God to help us. God does not give us strength, he rewards it. It is in the character of our citizens, it is a part of what has inspired these colonies to such a prominence, a healthy reliance on our own backs and our own hearts, a power of the mind that so threatens the British monarchy. We are a people who have shown the world we can help ourselves, that we have the God-given strength to stand for our liberty. God help us? No, sir. May God bless us. Adams stepped down, returned to his chair, and the silence was broken by brief cheers, calls from the gallery above. Franklin could feel his stomach churning with nervousness, sweat in his clothes. He looked at Adams. The man had his eyes cast down, evidently drained. How much more can be said? Franklin wondered. The talk is through. now Harrison was at the rostrum. The big man's voice, a booming contrast to Adams.
"We have a resolution before this chamber as presented 3 weeks ago by the Honorable Mr. Richard Henry Lee of Virginia. If there is no further debate, the chair would entertain a motion for a vote on the resolution."
Several hands rose, voices calling, and Franklin raised his own hand, joined the chorus. "So moved, seconded.
I will call out the name of each colony in their alphabetical order. Signify your vote."
Harrison took a long breath, seemed to say a brief prayer, and Franklin sat forward, his hands damp, the storm outside the only sound.
"Connecticut."
"Aye."
"Delaware."
Mr. President, I fear we are in some difficulty. The two delegates present from Delaware are divided on their vote."
All faces turned to the voice, and Franklin saw George Reed, the Delaware lawyer who had always sided with Dickinson. Harrison said,
"Only two? Where's Mr. Rodney?"
The door burst open in the back of the room, and Franklin saw a man stumbling in, drenched with the rain. The man removed his hat, wiped at his face, saw the eyes all focused on him, said,
"Pardon me, gentlemen, have I interrupted something of consequence?"
Reed sat abruptly, and Franklin saw disgust on the man's face. He smiled, heard Harrison say,
"Mr. Rodney, it seems you are the deciding vote for your delegation. The issue concerns the resolution calling for a declaration of independence."
Rodney moved toward the other two men from Delaware, and Franklin was watching Reed, could see the other man, Thomas McKean, speaking to the soaked Rodney, and now Rodney stood, said aloud,
"I believe the proper response is aye."
Harrison did not hesitate.
"Georgia."
"Aye."
"Maryland."
"Aye."
"Massachusetts."
Franklin saw Hancock stand, the man's voice booming.
"Aye."
"New Hampshire."
"Aye."
"New Jersey."
"Aye."
"New York."
"Mr. President."
Franklin saw Livingston stand now, and the man seemed embarrassed.
"The delegation from New York has received no authorization from our assembly."
There were murmurs now rolling through the room, shouts from the gallery, and Franklin felt a cold lump in his chest. "No, it cannot end because of that. They cannot delay us. Not now, not after so much." Livingston looked at the other men around him, and Franklin saw nods from the other New Yorkers, encouraging him to continue.
"Mr. President, in light of the sentiment expressed by this Congress, it is only proper that the delegation from New York abstain from casting a vote until such time as we are instructed otherwise by our assembly."
There was sudden applause, and Franklin felt swallowed by relief. Thank God there is wisdom to be found in the oddest places. Harrison pounded his gavel.
"The chair accepts the decision of the New York delegation. North Carolina."
"Aye."
"Pennsylvania."
There was a hushed pause, and Franklin saw movement by the main entranceway, the door opening slightly, two men slipping out quickly, leaving the chamber. He looked around, expected to see Dickinson and the other three Pennsylvanians, saw only two men, James Wilson and John Morton. Wilson leaned forward, close to Franklin, said quietly,
"Mr. Dickinson and Mr. Morris have done your cause a great courtesy. They have declined to offer a vote, leaving me a minority of one."
Wilson looked at the man beside him, said, "Since I assume, Mr. Morton, that your sentiments have not changed, you and Dr. Franklin are now a majority." Morton said in a low voice, "They have not changed, sir. I favor independence." Franklin turned, faced the rostrum, saw the expectant stare of Harrison, saw now every face in the room staring at him as well. He said,
"That would be aye."
"Rhode Island."
"Aye."
"South Carolina."
"Aye."
Harrison paused now, clearly enjoying the moment.
"Virginia."
"Aye."
"The motion is carried by unanimous vote."
Harrison's words were drowned out by the roar from the gallery, the delegates themselves now standing, hands going out, pats on the back. Franklin stood, pulled forward by the sudden release, a flood of infectious joy. He saw the Massachusetts delegation hemmed in by a crowd, Hancock's booming voice calling for a salute, Sam Adams beaming a wide smile. Franklin moved closer, saw John Adams now, the short man assaulted by the loud cheers, the kind appreciation of those he spoke for. The man seemed shaken, and Franklin pushed closer, the delegates pulling back in respect. Adams looked at him with an odd stare, his eyes glazed with emotion. Outside, the thunderstorm had passed, the windows now alive with sunlight, and Franklin saw Adams staring up that way, turned with him. The great chamber was echoing with sound, and Franklin moved closer, wanted to say something to the man, but there were no words, nothing that could measure the moment. He saw it in Adams' eyes as well, that there were no words left, the energy all in some other place. Adams still stared at the sunlight, the reflection on the tall windows, rays of new light cast through the room. The sounds began to flow outside, the words spreading out away from the State House, people in the street beyond shouting, and Adams seemed not to hear, looked at him now. Was I right, Doctor? Will God bless us? Franklin could not hold his emotions back now. He put a hand on the man's shoulder, his own head down, said in a low voice, "He already has, Mr. Adams." The Congress still had work to do, now considered the wording of the committee's actual declaration. Changes were made, as Franklin knew they would be, clarifications, omissions, concessions to those who had voted to approve the declaration despite their own hesitation, stubborn doubts that the colonies were truly prepared for the consequences. Jefferson had included a clause condemning the practice of slavery and laid the blame for the slave trade squarely on the shoulders of King George. There was resistance to this theme primarily from Georgia and South Carolina, whose economies were dependent on the continuation of slavery. Jefferson had also lashed out at the English people more of his poetic flair, the wistful sorrow that the friendship that had been so promising between the two peoples should now be laid to waste by the English obedience to their own corrupt leadership. There was a strong argument by the more conservative delegates that the best and last hope for some peaceful settlement of the crisis might yet be found in some outpouring of support that the colonists might receive from the English citizenry. Thus it was best not to antagonize them directly. The clauses were omitted. Jefferson retired to his room to complete the final draft as approved by the Congress. Though the resolution calling for a declaration of independence had already passed, the final document itself must still be approved. July 4th, 1776. They sat quietly, the gallery small, the citizens not seeming to be concerned with this last mundane bit of business regarding the Declaration of Independence. The debates were done, the wording changed to suit the sensitivities of every colony. Those who were still uneasy had given up their objections, and many of the delegates had already sent word back to their assemblies that the declaration had been approved. A clean and final copy had been made by Jefferson, none of the ink scratches in the margins, the crossed-out words, the scribbles and notes jotted in every space. He had brought it first to Adams, who had shown it to Franklin, who held it now, scanned the wording, while around him delegates were continuing to gather, expectant, patient. He studied the phrasing, the precision, searched nervously for some mistake, some addition Jefferson might have included, yet another point they would have to debate. But the young man had done as he was instructed, had incorporated all the changes necessary. Franklin lowered the document, looked at Adams. "I believe we may now proceed." Hancock was at the rostrum, and Adams took him the paper, then moved to his chair. Hancock struck his gavel once. "To order! If there is no objection, the chair will now read the document as offered by the committee and amended by this Congress." He set the gavel aside, raised the document Jefferson had finalized, a long rectangle of parchment, read slowly. "When, in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal." The words reached out to each of them. The delegates those above in the public seats, out beyond the walls of this one simple building. The words were carried by rider and post, copies posted in every town square, in every courthouse, every state house, every assembly hall. Like a great stone dropped into a vast, deep pond, the impact of the Declaration of Independence would flow out in waves that would reach far beyond the colonies, far beyond the people who had brought it to life. The words would spread beyond the great ocean, would reach the halls and stout buildings of a government that would still not understand, would still pretend to own the spirit of these unruly people, would insist that crushing that spirit meant crushing the people and whatever sham of an army these outrageous rebels would dare to mount. Chapter 45. Washington. New York, July 9th, 1776. He could see the warships far out in the harbor, their small shore boats in motion. Until his army had begun to arrive in New York, the British men of war had been anchored right along the wharves, one still serving as the official office of Governor Tryon. Once Washington's troops had begun to fortify the city, the ships had wisely sailed out beyond the range of colonial artillery, were anchored now in a position that effectively blocked anyone else from entering the harbor from the sea. Now the British sailors took their shore leave on Long Island, and most of the taverns and shops along the waterfront of the village of Brooklyn were firmly supportive of their British patrons. Charles Lee had reached the city before Washington, and along with Nathaniel Greene, had ignored whatever political divisiveness might still be found there, immediately beginning construction of barricades along the eastern shore of the city. Manhattan Island was densely populated at its southern tip, but northward, the vast majority of the island was mostly woods and empty pasture land. Defending the entire island was out of the question, especially since the rivers on both sides, the Hudson and the East River, were easily navigated by British warships, and for the most part were too wide to effectively plant any serious obstructions. The western shore of the island, along the Hudson, was blessedly difficult to assault, high banks along most of the waterfront. But the shores of the East River gently sloped to the water, and here Lee had his men construct defensive works manned by sharpshooters and the first cannon that had begun to arrive from Boston. North of the populated part of the island, Lee constructed a defensive line that spanned from one shore to the other. Preventing the British from landing on the northern half of Manhattan was impossible, but at least Lee could slow them down if they assaulted the city from above. Washington had inspected all the new construction by now, had established his new headquarters in a house near the southern tip of the city. The people had received him with appropriate warmth, surprising him, since it was no secret that even from his shipboard office, Governor Tryon still had an influential hand in much of the colony's political power. When Lee and Greene had arrived in Manhattan, leading the first columns of colonial troops from Boston, they had been enormously surprised that the British were not, in fact, waiting for them. From the time Howe's fleet had sailed away from Boston Harbor, they had simply disappeared, and the most hopeful among the command believed that the rumors in Boston might have been true after all. After the embarrassment of abandoning their base, Howe might simply have sailed for England. By the time Washington arrived in New York, the rumors had changed. Some of Tryon's staff had difficulty holding a secret. Washington had learned that Howe had gone to Halifax to refit and resupply, deposit his sick and wounded, and replace them not only with fresh British troops, but with the first of the mercenaries from Europe, the first shiploads of Hessian troops arriving in Halifax just in time to board Howe's transports for New York. The Declaration of Independence had reached his hand that morning, opening a torrent of good cheer around his headquarters. Washington's first reaction had been enormous relief, and he settled into a thick, soft chair in the sitting room, reading the document again several times. "God bless them," he thought. This required so much more than simple resolve, more than just the politics of making a protest to the king. This was an act of genuine courage. These men have placed their own necks in the king's noose. In one small dark place in his memory, he held on to the words of Artemus Ward, the nagging fear that the Congress might simply dissolve, the differences and controversies too great. But the fear was gone now, the paper in his hand sweeping it away. This has united us. No matter what our other differences, we have come together for the most important task of all. There can no longer be any argument about the interests of Massachusetts conflicting with those of Virginia. We now share much more than anything that may divide us. He set the paper aside, had already given the order to his staff that the troops now in the city would assemble at midday, would hear this document read aloud. He pulled out his pocket watch, said aloud, "Time to go." The troops had gathered in the great green park that spread alongside Broad Street on a hilltop near Trinity Church. The troops had formed in a hollow square, a formation the British had used in combat for centuries. As the men tightened their ranks, the officers sharpening the corners of the square, Washington had already wondered if these troops would ever use it in combat at all. He climbed the steps of the platform, built just this morning, stared out at his army, 7,000 men from 6 different colonies, an extraordinary variety of dress, some clusters of similar uniforms, others appearing to be civilians, groups of men who might as well be attending a town meeting or some sporting event. But despite their differences, they had one distinct similarity. Nearly all of them had muskets now. And as they stood in line under the noonday sun, shoulder to shoulder, Washington felt what they all were feeling now, could see it in their faces, all focused on their commander. By God, we are an army. To one side, a corps of musicians was playing, the sharp roll of the drumbeat blending with the high-pitched song of the fife, the rhythm wrapping around the troops, holding them neat in their formation. Beyond, the citizens had gathered in thick lines as well, surrounding the park, the social elite standing with the rabble of the street, as much a blend of finery and common homespun as the soldiers they admired. The time had come. The staff now in place behind him, Lee, Green, Knox, many of the officers close in front of the platform. He turned, nodded to Gates, who stepped forward, raised a short sword. It was the signal to the musicians, and abruptly the music stopped. There was a roll of applause from the civilians, and Washington could see Gates react with mild horror. Washington wanted to tell him, "It's all right, you can't control the civilians, too." Gates seemed to accept his fate, stepped back into line behind him. Washington looked out across the crowd, suddenly realized the focus was on him. He turned to the side, nodded to the young officer close by, the man selected both for his ability to read eloquently and for the volume of his voice. Washington now handed the officer the document, a tight roll of paper, could see nervousness in the man's face. "Whenever you are ready, Mr. Brown," said Washington. The man slowly unrolled the paper, glanced at the general, and Washington turned, inclined his head toward Gates again, who said aloud, "The army will come to attention. As ordered by the commanding general, this army will now hear the declaration as approved by the Continental Congress on July 4th, the year of our Lord, 1776. The young officer now stepped forward, began to read. Washington saw the words in his mind, so much of it now permanent inside him. He could see their faces in that great chamber, had already imagined hearing them debate. The confident certainty of Richard Henry Lee, the emotion of Patrick Henry, the pure, clear logic of John Adams. He tried to focus on the faces in front of him now, saw no one looking away, the entire sea of soldiers and civilians attentive to the young officer's words. There were shouts now, a few responding to certain phrases, some men cheering the charges against King George. "For quartering large bodies of troops among us, for protecting them by a mock trial from punishment for any murders which they should commit on the inhabitants of these states." There were more cheers now, others straining forward to hear. "For imposing taxes on us without our consent." There was a thunder of approval, and Washington glanced toward Brown, saw the man pause, waiting for the noise to subside. Washington nodded his approval, and the man continued to read. The cheers seemed to grow again, slowly, gradually the spirit of the entire audience rising as the power of the Declaration reached into each one of them. Washington was still reciting the words silently as the officer read them, closed his eyes now, knew it was near the closing. That these United Colonies are, and of right ought to be, free and independent states. That they are absolved from all allegiance to the British Crown, and that all political connection between them and the state of Great Britain is and ought to be totally dissolved, and that as free and independent states they have full power to levy war, conclude peace, contract alliances, establish commerce, and to do all other acts and things which independent states may of right do. And for the support of this declaration, with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. Washington opened his eyes, saw the young soldier staring at the paper, tears on the man's cheeks. Brown lowered the paper now, and the crowd understood, the low roar beginning to grow louder, the pitch and the volume rising with the hats that began to fly. The soldiers held their muskets high, and Washington was smiling, shared the emotions with all of them. He could hear some men calling his name, others standing quietly with their hands in the air, more tears. Beyond the formation of soldiers, the townspeople began to move, accompanied by new cheers, words he couldn't hear. They began in one long flow, moving to the south, down Broad Street, past Trinity Church, down the long hill, toward Bowling Green. They brought ropes, and a flood of men began to climb up and over the iron picket fence, the ropes slung high, draped over the gold statue. Men jumped up on the statue's base, reaching beneath the belly of the horse, some climbing higher, securing the ropes into fat knots around the golden figure of the rider. Out beyond the picket fence, the crowd around the green continued to grow, the cheering and shouts unceasing. The men inside the fence began to line up along the taut ropes, one man shouting above the din, directing them. The ropes grew tighter, and the massive golden statue suddenly moved, fueling a new roar from the crowd. It rocked slightly, shifting on its base, then, as the men gave one final pull, the great golden horse and rider toppled, gouging heavily into the soft earth of the green. The cheers were deafening now, and one man pounced on the head of the rider, the golden face of King George, the expression immobile, oblivious, the cold metal unchanged. But the man had a saw, knelt down, began to cut, the skill of a craftsman, a man who has done this kind of work before. Around him, the men with the ropes urged him on, the man cutting with a feverish energy. When the head was severed, the man held it up high to the mass of people, the sounds exploding again. As the man carried the severed piece of metal in a parade around the green, another man stood close to the statue, saw the hollow place where the man had cut. The gold was only gilt, a thin plating over a massive piece of metal. The man knelt down, knew something of metal and weapons, and now he smiled, realized something that the great throng around him might not yet know. His hand touched the metal inside, soft and gray. Lead. There was more value to this statue than simply as a symbol of the fallen power of England. It could be melted into musket balls. Broad Street was still packed solid with the celebration. But Washington had prepared his horse to be close by, knew if he stayed near the people they might mob him. He had made this ride each day, a routine that would have been a pleasant diversion had the purpose not been so very serious. He wound the horse quickly through the narrow streets, followed closely by his guard, the hand-picked men who accompanied him everywhere he went now. They rode out away from the park, turned northward. He could still hear the sounds from the great crowd, but quickly they faded away behind him. He guided the horse up a long rise, followed a trail that ran toward the Hudson. There were trees here, but he knew they would quickly give way, the bluff along the river bare, the vantage point he had come to know so well. He stopped the horse, saw the Hudson bathed in the afternoon sun, a glow of golden fire, the clean surface unbroken, no boats, no sign of any traffic at all. The guard knew his routine by now, stayed back behind him in silent formation. He climbed down from the horse, reached into his saddlebag, pulled out the spyglass. The rumors had come to him for several days, colonial privateers sending word of the approach of the great fleet. He scanned the horizon to the southeast, the mouth of the harbor, saw the familiar British warships at anchor, the same pattern as before. He lowered his view to the East River, across to Brooklyn, no change, nothing new. He began to feel relief, could hear his own breathing, looked again to the southeast, toward the mouths of the two rivers, the tip of the island, could see the mass of people still around Bowling Green, the government buildings, what had once been Gage's headquarters. He raised the glass, saw clouds to the south, along the horizon, suddenly lowered the glass. He wiped the eyepiece with his shirt, raised the glass again, stared toward the south, Staten Island, could see now the clouds were not clouds at all. They were sails. He felt his heart begin to pound, a hard anticipation growing in his chest, could see it clearly now, the fleet gathering around the far end of Staten Island. It was another indefensible place, the landmass too large for the troops he had, the island surrounded by water too deep and too open for him to obstruct. He had expected that Howe would understand how useful that place could be, a staging area, large enough to assemble whatever size force Howe was bringing with him. He tried to count the ships, but the sails were massed together, and he lowered the glass. Could see them with his eyes now. Thought, yes, of course, he understands. And no matter the importance of this city, we cannot truly defend this place. But I cannot just withdraw. If we are so much weaker than they are, we cannot concede that, announce our weakness by just marching away. The people would not receive that well, and neither would the Congress. He looked out now to the west, the sun settling low, the Hudson still a glorious show. He thought of the Congress, wondered how they would respond to Howe's arrival. Certainly, there would be some sense of relief, putting the rumors to rest that Howe might suddenly appear at Philadelphia. He had never believed that, knew the value of New York, the river below him, the crucial artery splitting the colonies in two. No, the Congress is safe for now. Howe will focus right here. It's what I would do. He thought of the assembly in the park, his soldiers standing tall, hearing the words from the Declaration. He'd try to see the faces of the men in the Congress again, wished he had been there for the vote. The raw power of that moment, something no one there would ever forget. Those men have done all they can do. They have spoken with one voice. They have given this nation a beginning, a point in time from which all else will follow. But it will only mean something if we can win. He raised the glass again, but did not look, knew already what he would see. There is an army out there with one mission. So now it will be up to us, to all these men who are learning to call themselves soldiers. Now, we will learn if we can fight a war. Afterward. Lieutenant General Thomas Gage. Upon his return to London in November 1775, the ministry, by its lack of attention to him, confirms what he already knew to be true. But Lord Germain allows Gage to languish as a commander with no command until April 1776, when he is finally notified by Germain that his status as army commander-in-chief is terminated. He is still, however, the royal governor of Massachusetts, and as do so many of King George's governors, he reigns in exile. The post provides him a respectable salary, however, sufficient to maintain a comfortable though modest household for his family. still regarded with respect by King George, in 1781 he is asked to supervise a potential defense of England from a rumored invasion by the French, which never materializes. When the Revolutionary War draws to an end and Germain is removed from power in 1782, the king facilitates Gage's promotion to full general. He never serves in any official military capacity and suffers from failing health, dies in 1787 at age 68. He is regarded by most of his contemporaries and by history as a competent military commander and an otherwise decent man who, by extraordinarily bad fortune, is thrust into the forefront of one of Britain's most complex and devastating military calamities. While history may cast harsh judgment on his actions, no one has yet concluded who, of all those commanders then available, would have performed the duty with any more positive results for his country. In the 1850s, a portrait of the colony's last royal governor is donated to the state of Massachusetts by Gage's youngest son, then an admiral in the British Navy. It now hangs in the state capital. The debate about Margaret Gage's role in the military activity around Boston is unsolved and uncertain. There continues to be pointed speculation that she had ample motive and means to provide the Sons of Liberty with crucial information, as contrasted by the argument that no loyal wife of that time would commit such an abominable offense. There is only sketchy evidence for either view. After her husband's death, she remains in England with her family. She dies in 1824, at age 90. Governor Thomas Hutchinson. He remains idle in England, always naively holding to the belief that when the war is settled, he will once again return to his native Massachusetts and resume office. He seems to those around him to be possessed of desperation, hanging on every word of the progress of the war. His daughter, Peggy, the namesake of his late much-beloved wife, is stricken with a lengthy illness and dies in 1777 at age 23. Her death is a blow from which he will never recover. He is a tragic man in many ways, destined to die and be buried in exile, roundly despised by the people of his home state. He endures the final years of a lonely life by focusing on his writing, publishes several historical works, including a critical study of public sentiment titled The Witchcraft Delusion of 1692. Suffering a stroke, he dies in June 1780 at age 69. He was born to be the cause and the victim of popular fury, outrage, and conflagration. He was perhaps the only man in the world who could have brought on the controversy between Great Britain and America in the manner and at the time it was done. John Adams, January 1781. Governor Hutchinson is dead. Obituary, The Boston Independent Chronicle, January 1781. Samuel Adams. His greatest mission in life now successful, his signature on the Declaration, the man to whom Jefferson refers as truly the man of the Revolution, now finds himself in a role to which he is not only unaccustomed, but ill-suited. With no controversy to stir, and no longer a populace to inflame, Sam settles into his position in the Congress, but quickly becomes bored. Without the turmoil of behind-the-scenes intrigue, he creates his own, alienating many in the Congress who had formerly rallied behind his cause. He serves until 1781, returns to Boston and nearly fades into obscurity, barely survives financially by managing the family business, a noted brewery, which he had inherited from his father. He runs against John Hancock for the governor's seat, fails against Hancock's inexplicable popularity, serves instead as lieutenant governor until Hancock's death in 1793. Finally elected on his own accord in 1794, he serves for 4 years. He dies in 1803 at age 81. John Dickinson. The most ardent opponent of the Declaration of Independence continues to serve in whatever capacity his people will support, including service on the committee that drafts the Articles of Confederation. In a move that would surprise his enemies in the Congress, in 1777 he responds to the escalation of the Revolutionary War by enlisting as a private in a Delaware regiment, and participates in the Battle of Brandywine. His explanation reflects his sensitivity to the public criticism he has received.
I can form no idea of a more noble fate than to resign my life for the defense and happiness of those unkind countrymen whom I cannot forbear to esteem as fellow citizens amidst their fury against me." He eventually serves as a colonel and then a brigadier general, but does not see further military action. He settles in Delaware, continues to serve in the Congress from that state, then returns to Pennsylvania, and in 1783 founds Dickinson College. Though in his later life he holds no political office, he continues to write in a political vein, publishes several articles, including a passionate call for a continuing alliance with France. Always frail and sickly in appearance, he nonetheless outlives many of his political rivals. He dies in Philadelphia in 1808, at age 76. Royal Governor William Franklin. Labeled by the New Jersey Assembly an enemy to the liberties of this country, he is imprisoned in a private home in Connecticut, where the confinement is more imagined than restrictive. He continues to act on behalf of Loyalist interests, corresponds openly with General Howe in New York. George Washington loses tolerance for William's open disregard of his circumstance and orders him jailed in Litchfield, Connecticut. All during this period, he never again sees his wife, Elizabeth, who has been escorted by British troops to the safety of New York. Lonely and in fragile health, she dies in mid-1777 and is buried at St. Paul's Church. In 1778, he is exchanged, freed, and remains around New York, serves as president of the Associated Alliance of Loyalists. The alliance proves to be much more a band of vigilantes than any political organization, and under severe pressure from George Washington, they are disbanded in 1782. William goes to England, and 2 years later attempts to reconcile with his father, who is now in France. Ben Franklin responds to his son's request for a renewal of their relationship with a terse, though positive, response. They meet briefly in France, but their relationship is never truly restored, and when the father dies, William is angrily disappointed by his inheritance, which amounts essentially to nothing, and includes this final note from his father: "The part he acted against me in the late war, which is of public notoriety, will account for my leaving him no more of an estate he endeavored to deprive me of." Bitter and unpopular in England, William spends the rest of his life in unwise property speculation and dies alone in 1813 at age 82. It is his son, Temple, who preserves and subsequently publishes much of Ben Franklin's written work. Mrs. Margaret Stevenson. Ben Franklin's landlady in London could be described as one of the true loves of his life. Though she never sees him again after his departure from London in 1775, the two continue an exchange of letters that demonstrates their affection. When Franklin goes to France, her letters follow him, and there is much talk of her making a visit which never occurs. Her financial and physical health both begin to fail, and she is forced to leave London for the British countryside and move in with her daughter Polly, who had been the object of another of Franklin's most cherished relationships. Mrs. Stevenson continues to plan for the day when she might again fritter about the house of her famous tenant, and writes him constantly to expect her visit. "Don't be surprised if I pack myself up." But she is betrayed by her health and dies on New Year's Day, 1783. In mourning the loss of one so close, Franklin writes, "This has begun to take away the rest, and strikes the hardest." Despite all the rumors of impropriety that surrounded Franklin and Margaret Stevenson, and in fact have continued to follow Franklin for two centuries, there is no evidence to show that their relationship was anything beyond that of the dearest and most affectionate of friends. Richard Henry Lee. He serves the Continental Congress until 1780, continues his friendship with both Sam and John Adams. He returns in 1784 and is elected president of the Congress. As the new United States Constitution is being created, Lee takes a hard stand against the potential abuses of a strong federal government and is instrumental in helping create the Bill of Rights. Despite failing health, he accepts the urgings of John Adams and Patrick Henry
and is elected by Virginia to the new United States Senate, where he serves until 1792. He dies in his home state in 1794 at age 62. Will Strawn. Even Ben Franklin concedes that Strawn, the King's royal printer and member of the British Parliament, is and always has been his best friend, for the many years they both live. During the war, their correspondence is sparse, and though Strawn maintains his affection for Franklin in their letters, Franklin does not respond in kind, still resentful that Strawn continues his unwavering loyalty to England and its cause. In spring 1776, upon learning of Franklin's ill-advised journey to Canada, Strawn writes, "I wish your great talents had found other employment." Strawn continues to be a good friend and supporter of William Franklin, uses his influence to some effect in having the imprisoned governor released. After the Revolutionary War, Strawn urges Ben Franklin to return home to England, but Franklin is in France and far from a peaceful retirement. Strawn's health begins to fail him, and unlike his friend, he loses the strength for long journeys and is nearly blind. In 1785, as Franklin begins his final journey back to America, the two men plan to meet in Southampton, England. Strawn dies 2 weeks before Franklin arrives. He is 76. Major General Artemas Ward. He never recovers from what he perceives as the slight by Congress to his military abilities, and after the British abandon Boston, Ward will not accompany the army as it marches to New York. He instead offers his resignation from the Continental Army in April 1776. It is accepted in the Congress with no debate. Washington writes an indiscreet criticism of Ward, describing his resignation as Ward's willingness to serve as long as he was not called upon to stray far from the smoke of his own chimney. Ward continues to serve as commander of militia around Boston, continues to show no skill in the position, finally incurring the wrath of the Massachusetts Assembly, the very body that had once championed him for overall command of the army. He dies in 1800 at age 73. John Hancock. He serves in the Continental Congress until 1777, then receives his much-cherished commission as a Major General of Militia. But his service in the field is consistent with the mediocrity of his civilian accomplishments, and he sees little action. In September 1780, he becomes the first governor of the state of Massachusetts, serves until ill health forces him to resign in 1785. Elected to the Continental Congress that year, and chosen as its president once more, he holds office for 2 years without ever actually attending a session. In 1788, he serves as president of the Massachusetts Convention to ratify the new United States Constitution, is stricken with health problems again, resigns. When the debates stalemate, he is called upon by other delegates who recognize that his name still carries great influence, and he has discreetly provided a list of compromises to break the deadlock. Presenting them as his own creation, he thus receives considerable and undeserved prestige as a statesman. He is elected again as the state's governor, serves 6 years, until his death in 1793 at the age of 56. Paul Revere. Widely regarded to have been one of the Mohawks who participated in the Boston Tea Party, he is ultimately of more service to the revolutionary cause for his abilities as a political cartoonist and metallurgist than as a soldier. He serves Washington's army by supervising the manufacture of powder and shot in Massachusetts, eventually receives a military commission as a major of militia, commands the colonial garrison at Castle William. In 1779, he participates in the Penobscot expedition, a naval battle of disastrous consequence for the colonists, and is brought before a court-martial. But since he is a junior officer and the blame lies more with senior command, the court exonerates him. After the war, he assumes a small role in the creation of the United States Constitution, continues his career as a noted silversmith. He improves his skills in the manufacture of more heavy implements, including cannon, and his company produces much of the metal used in the construction of the USS Constitution, Old Ironsides. He develops a system for rolling copper into sheets and contributes to the manufacture of inventor Robert Fulton's first steam-powered boat. His skills extend to the manufacture of false teeth, and thus is born the legend that he supplies the dentures used by George Washington. But there is no evidence to support the entertaining anecdote. His engraving talents bring him to create the first seal of the state of Massachusetts, which is still in use today. His first wife dies in 1773, and he marries again, has a total of 16 children. He outlives his second wife and dies in 1818 at age 83. Relatively unknown and unremembered after his death, it is Longfellow's The Midnight Ride of Paul Revere, written in 1863, that creates the aura around his most historically memorable accomplishment. Longfellow is thus responsible for not only elevating Revere's works of silver to extraordinary value, but keeping the name of Paul Revere alive in the lore of the United States that every child learns in school. William Pitt, Lord Chatham. The man who had saved King George's throne by his heroism in the Seven Years' War with France still carries so much animosity toward the French that when France is rumored to be entering the Revolution in an alliance with the colonies, Chatham shifts his political position. In 1778, there is a proposal debated in the House of Lords calling for extreme effort at peace with America because of nervousness about the potential risk to England if France does indeed join the war. Chatham, who supported colonial success at the expense of English pride, now reverses course, cannot stomach a loss of English pride by showing a fear of the French, whom he has already bested in war. In May 1778, participating in the spirited debate on the floor of the House of Lords, he collapses and dies suddenly, apparently of a heart attack, at age 70. Thomas Paine. The man arguably the most responsible for uniting the American people behind the theme of independence spends the rest of his life in an attempt to duplicate the glory and notoriety he earns from common sense. He serves briefly in the Continental Army with no distinction, continues to write long and thoughtful essays on the state of man. Despite the enormous circulation of common sense in 1776, it is another virtually unknown article, The Crisis, that contains the single line for which he is best remembered. These are the times that try men's souls. As a government bureaucrat in England, he had struggled to keep a position. In America, he soon establishes a reputation as a disagreeable, slovenly man who shows no patience for argument. His writings become long-winded and hostile attacks on what most people consider the accepted order, including an assault on religion titled The Age of Reason, described by many as the Atheist's Bible. He returns to England in 1787 and would have been accepted for the reputation of his writing, but his personal conflicts with those of powerful influence result instead in his arrest for treason, the ministry's revenge for common sense. Allowed to leave for France, he is arrested yet again, this time in Paris, after he voices loud support for the political party that is in disfavor at the time. In 1796, one of his final essays is published. The letter to George Washington is a brutal and highly inappropriate assault on the aging man who is clearly the nation's most revered hero. The essay is a stark contrast to his The American Citizen, which includes an exposition of yellow fever that Thomas Jefferson calls one of the most sensible performances on that disease that had come under my observation. Paine returns to America in 1802, settles in New Jersey and New York City, destroys his own health by a combination of excessive drinking and a grotesque lack of personal hygiene, and dies in June 1809 at age 72. His admirers are many, and for the next two centuries, his writings will inspire revolutionary and radical movements in Europe and America. From Napoleon to Walt Whitman to the founders of the American labor movement, his theories are toasted and venerated. While his words survive and continue to influence, there is wonderment that this man who so changed history would be himself so unremarkable. The Declaration of Independence. The document voted to final approval on July 4, 1776, is signed that day only by the President of the Continental Congress, John Hancock. The unanimity that the Congress had so valued comes finally on July 9, 1776, when, possibly inspired by George Washington's rally in the Great Park, the New York Assembly finally votes its approval. The final and official document is not written until July 19th, and is signed by the delegates beginning on August 2, 1776, when approximately 50 signatures are affixed. 6 more are added in the weeks that follow, the latest possibly in January 1777. For the protection of the signers themselves, the signed document is not released publicly until January 18, 1777. Several of the Declaration's staunchest opponents ultimately signed the document, including Morris of Pennsylvania and Rutledge of South Carolina. Signatures notably missing include, of course, that of John Dickinson, but also that of Patrick Henry, who was not in attendance at the time. The original document is on public display, housed permanently in the National Archives in Washington, D.C. And from this story, John Adams, Abigail Adams, Benjamin Franklin, Temple Franklin, George Washington, Martha Washington, Nathaniel Greene, Henry Knox, Benedict Arnold, Horatio Gates, Charles Lee, William Prescott, Daniel Morgan, and Richard Howe, William Howe, John Burgoyne, King George III. For 6 years, these men and women will endure the tragedies and consequences of a war that will rage across the colonies, a desperate struggle between old and new, between a government led by a monarch who holds mightily to the preservation of his empire, opposed by an extraordinary force the like of which the world has never seen, a people united and inspired to fight above all for their own individuality. The best trained and most disciplined military force in the world will confront an opponent whose greatest asset is their spirit and their passion for their cause. The outcome will change the history of the world. But that is a story for another time.
The End. You've been listening to Rise to Rebellion by Jeff Shara, narrated by George Goodell. If you've enjoyed this book and this performance, Recorded Books recommends Seabiscuit by Laura Hillenbrand, narrated by Richard M. Davidson. You'll find a wide selection of titles in the Recorded Books catalog, including bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more. So to order another Recorded Book or for a copy of our latest listing, please call us using the toll-free number found on the back of the book. You can order by phone with any major credit card, or by writing to us, or by faxing us. Don't forget to ask about easy 30-day rentals by mail. On our website, you can browse the catalog, hear about the latest releases, place orders, or tune into narrator profiles and author interviews. So visit us there at www.recordedbooks.com. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.